Kunti Devi is expressing her heart to Krishna. And sometimes when we talk in a very intimate way, or sometimes it may be in an angry way, our feelings, our heart, our true mood, what we're actually thinking comes out deeply. Usually, we don't think deeply. Our words reflect that living on the superficial level. But Kunti Devi is not like that, and not in that situation at all. Pramiti, please ask the devotees in charge of the banging to have them bang later. Huh? Yeah, but they should just do it right in front. Huh? So Kunti Devi, we heard the first verse of her concluding prayers, the concluding part of her prayers yesterday. And when it comes to it, she's saying, are you really leaving? This is intolerable for her, because her love for Krishna is so deep. So she says, oh my Lord, and we heard this yesterday, you have executed all duties yourself. Are you leaving us today, though we are completely dependent on your mercy and have no one else to protect us, now when all kings are at enmity with us? As the name and fame, this is text 38, as the name and fame of a particular body is finished with the disappearance of the living spirit, similarly, if you do not look upon us, all our fame and activities, along with the Pandavas and Yadus, will end at once. Without you, she's saying, we have nothing. Yes, we've obtained our position. Yes, we have the fame of the famous Pandava dynasty. We have that glorious name and fame. Our activities thus far have proven so wonderful, protected at every turn, surviving and flourishing throughout the battle of Kurukshetra. But yet, if you leave us now, our situation will be the same as a body whose soul has left. And what happens to that body? Practically speaking, it ceases to be. It ends at once. It instantaneously, immediately begins to decompose. We have nothing without you. Why is Krishna leaving?
Friends, you're welcome.
Yes. Why else is Krishna leaving? His mission is finished. Yes, it's true. Why else? Why else? So that's a combination of both. Yes. But why else? These are all completely true. Yes. But also, he wants to increase the attachment of Kunti Devi. And Krishna has his way of doing that, because the nature of a devotee is, and it's not only the nature of a devotee, it's the nature of everyone. I guess that's because everyone is a devotee. But you don't realize how much affection and love you have for something or someone until either it's taken away from you, or that person is leaving, or it's just before the time that that person is leaving, and then you realize, oh no, in just a few moments, although he's standing before me right now, he's going to be gone. And then the affection, then the attachment comes right to the surface. Before it was there, but somewhat unconscious, because when you're with someone every day and you're used to them coming and going, then, oh yes, Krishna's there, Krishna, oh yes, Krishna's there. But when he's going to leave, then whatever feelings are there, they become extreme, intensified. So why is Krishna doing this? So one reason is to intensify the attachment that Kunti Devi is experiencing. And what is the benefit for us of doing that? Because then we get to hear the prayers of Kunti Devi. Because the devotees' hearts are very deep, they are grave, and sometimes they are very hard to understand. But when something like this occurs, if we're present, then everything that is in the depths gets brought to the surface. And therefore we, who don't have access to the depths, can understand, because they're expressing things directly. So it's Krishna's mercy on us also that he leaves, not only on the residents of Hastinapur, because their attachment increases, and not only on the affection on the residents of Dwarka, because they're getting their prayers met and they're going to get to see Krishna, but also upon us, because we get to hear Kunti Devi's prayers. So this is how she's experiencing Krishna's presence. That without you, Krishna, and she's not exaggerating, we have nothing. We are nothing. Practically speaking, we don't exist. Like the body, the person no longer exists when the soul is no longer present in the body. There is no meaning to the person anymore. Similarly, there's no meaning to us being Pandavas anymore. How much dependence, attachment Kunti Devi has. And then we take our own, or at least I can't speak as a group, but for myself, the attachment and dependence on Krishna. And then when looking at a mountain, maybe if I walk in a city in the West, and I'm dressed in a devotee, as a devotee in a dhoti, and I can think, oh, I'm a devotee, I know something about Krishna. But compared to Kunti Devi, looking at a mountain, we feel so tiny. Oh, Krishna's leaving? Okay, I have so many other things to do anyway. I'll go on with my life. What's the problem? I don't suffer from low self-esteem or codependency in any way. And this is actually the fact that we are completely dependent on Krishna for everything. Everything. We remain unaware of that, and Kunti Devi is always aware of it. Prabhupada's purport. Kunti Devi is quite aware that the existence of the Pandavas is due to Sri Krishna only. The Pandavas are undoubtedly well established in name and fame and are guided by the great King Yudhisthira, who is morality personified. And the Yadus are undoubtedly great allies. But without the guidance of Lord Krishna, all of them are non-entities. As much as the senses of the body are useless without the guidance of consciousness. No one should be proud of his prestige, power, and fame without being guided by the favor of the Supreme Lord. The living beings are always dependent, and the ultimate dependable object is the Lord himself. We depend on so many other things, and we are depending upon that which is not dependable. And therefore, Pashanapina Pashyati, although we have seen it, we are still in illusion, in Maya, and we depend on so many other infallible entities and situations that if we use just a tiny bit of our intelligence, or if we come away from our superficial consciousness, which is usually what's going on day after day after day. Superficial means just on the surface, no depth. Then everyone, if we come off the superficial platform, can immediately understand at least that everything in the world of matter is not dependable. And yet, we depend upon it foolishly, and yet, and amazingly, we become surprised when it lets us down. Shocked, how could that have happened? And suddenly we become frightened and we see the fragility of our position in the material world as if it wasn't fragile before. Our illusion was thicker, that is all. And we weren't aware of the danger that is always present in this world and how we're only really, truly depending on Krishna. So the Pandavas, different from us, were consciously and continuously aware of this. No one should be proud, Prabhupada said, of his prestige, power, and fame without being guided by the favor of the Lord. The living beings are always dependent, and the ultimate dependable object is the Lord himself. That's the meaning of absolute truth, that every other truth depends upon him. We may, therefore, invent by our advancement of material knowledge all sorts of counteracting material resources, but without being guided by the Lord, all such inventions end in fiasco, however strong and stout the reactionary elements may be. So Kunti Devi is displaying her dependence on Krishna, which is the essence of surrender. It is the essence of being awake to reality in the material world. And she's kindly, by Krishna's mercy, displaying this for our benefit. She continues, O Gadadhar. What does Gadadhar mean? Holder, Dhara, holding on tightly to the Gada. So Krishna also holds the gada or the club. O Krishna, O Gadadhar, our kingdom is now being marked by the impressions of your feet. That is the most valuable thing. The residents of Vrindavan, because Krishna would walk through the forests of Vrindavan without his shoes, therefore his lotus footprints would be everywhere in Vrindavan, and the residents of Vrindavan would always respect them, and they would never step on them, over them, or somehow cover them up, because this was such a prized possession. And the earth itself, Vrindavana Sakhi Bhuva Vidinoti Kirti Yadhivaki Sutta Parambhuja Labdha Lakshmi, to be touched by the lotus feet of Krishna was the great opulence of Vrindavan and the earth. But very often we don't value the opulence and fortunes that we have been given, especially in Krishna consciousness. So our kingdom, Kunti Devi says, is now being marked by the impressions of your feet. And therefore it appears beautiful. But when you leave, it will no longer be so. So Kunti Devi is saying, on one level, she's talking specifically about the kingdom, that it is so wonderful, so opulent, so beautiful, but when it is no longer marked by your lotus feet, it loses its everything. Like the body losing its soul. And practically speaking, everything when touched by Krishna becomes beautiful. And anything beautiful without Krishna becomes hollow and dead. I remember my first experience of this when after chanting Hare Krishna for a short time and living in the temple and then going home to my parents' house. And it was the same house, and I was, of course, so used to it because I had grown up there. But suddenly, it appeared dead and devoid of life because there was nothing to do with Krishna. There was no life in it. And it was it's like when, if you've ever walked into a lawyer's office, there's this sort of deadening feeling that comes along with it, that sort of it sinks you. So anything minus Krishna is lacking life. It's lacking beauty. How could something be beautiful without life? So Kunti Devi is experiencing this. If you leave, we're gone. We're finished. How could you be leaving now? All these cities and villages are flourishing in all respects because the herbs and grains are in abundance. The trees are full of fruits, the rivers are flowing, the hills are full of minerals, and the ocean full of wealth. And this is all due to your glancing over them. So without Krishna, that which is beautiful and flourishing becomes dead. Anything plus Krishna will become valuable. I remember when Prabhupada went to Tokyo, Japan in 1970, he was walking in a park and they have temples a temple in the park, but it was a Japanese Shinto temple which has no deity in it because it's just for appeasing the forefathers or something like that. And Prabhupada walked into that temple in the main park in Tokyo, and he said, "It is dead, it has no life." So that's how she was experiencing the kingdom without Krishna's presence. Death, dead, no life. And all the opulence we have is due to your glance. Here's Prabhupada's purport, and he makes preaching points. Human prosperity flourishes by natural gifts and not by gigantic industrial enterprises. Gigantic industrial enterprises brings death. The more that the countries of the world put their economics and economic development in the center, what happens? The whole ecological system becomes ruined. They'll kill the planet. They'll pull the oil from the planet. They'll mine everything from it. They turn everything into a disaster. The more that economics is unchecked and thought of as the purpose of existence, the more everything becomes a disaster. When the real purpose of existence isn't recognized. So Prabhupada's going to speak about this. The gigantic industrial enterprises are products of a godless civilization. Why? There's no respect for the earth. The earth is considered mother, Mother Earth. Why else? Just, yes, exploitation. Who cares? Let the environment be ruined. Let the atmosphere be ruined. Let there be no trees. Let the water be ruined. Who cares? It's insane, actually. It's slitting one's own throat. And it's all caused by, on one side, lack of God consciousness, on the other side, rampant materialism. And they cause the godless civilization, it causes the destruction of the noble aims of human life. Because if you take materialism and increase the fever of it, then the simple Krishna conscious aims of life, even noble aims, even materially noble aims, become very impractical and unattractive. And you see this with the children. When the children are cranked up towards computers and video games and television and all the virtual effects in a movie, and then you ask them to do something simple, like sit down and chant Hare Krishna for a few minutes, and they can't. They can't sit down. They can't focus their minds, practically speaking. And it's increasing. This mood of just speeding things up is increasing at such a rapid rate that the movies, you get these movies coming out of Hollywood that there's just one thing after the next, boom, 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 boom. I saw one cartoon, not animated cartoon, but a newspaper type of cartoon. And there was this, it was a Calvin and Hobbes cartoon, which sometimes they're very, very clever. So this one little boy is watching television, and there's one thing after the next, boom, 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 boom. And he says, boy, look at the speed that things are moving in this. And the companion with him, who happens to be a tiger of sorts, he says, yes, in contemporary civilization, it has been proved that no one has an attention span of more than 10 seconds. So therefore, they have to keep the images always moving, moving, to keep everyone's attention. What do you think about that? And the boy says, about what? Are you still talking about thinking about that, what I just said? Because boom, 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 instantaneous, immediate gratification. If it's not there, no one has an interest. And our message is very simple. Sit down, simple living, high thinking, chant Hare Krishna. And it is so hard for people's minds to slow down to the level where they can actually take something simple over a period of time, because the senses are demanding, 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 because they've been so sped up in youth and impressions are there. And the mind is so contaminated by the modes of passion and ignorance that something simple just simply seems boring and old-fashioned. And of course, as we spoke of previously, the philosophy is there to prove that they're right. We're evolving. This might have been good for the last generation or five generations ago when people were more primitive, but now we've advanced so much since then. We've evolved. So if we become like that, it will be some type of a retro generation. We'll be going backwards. Can't do that. We have to go forward. We can't impede progress. So how Kali Yuga, in the name of making progress, is messing everything up so clearly, so obviously, and no one wishes to see it. And even more than that, no one will do anything about it because it will interfere with their sense enjoyment. So attached to the sense enjoyment, that even if they see that the world is going to hell, and environmentally it's obvious to everyone, even if they see it undeniably and clearly, even if the polar ice caps are melting, and these little nations in the South Pacific are going underwater, no one will stop. They can't stop. It is the nature of Kali and the mode of passion and illusion. So it stems really from the noble aims of human life being lost. The purpose of life, and Prabhupada has explained on so many occasions, and I've been hearing him recently say so, that this is specifically India's contribution. And instead of trying to compete with the West for sense enjoyment, for economic development, instead they should make their actual contribution of a simple life based on the noble aims and God realization. The more we go on increasing such troublesome industries to squeeze out the vital energy of human beings. And recently I was in, I passed through a city town near Melbourne named Geelong where they have all these car factories. And when I was passing through there, it just happened to be the time when everyone was getting out of work. So I had the opportunity to look at their faces as they were getting off the assembly lines and this meaningless, vital energy-sucking work, and their faces reflected such misery. Even after they were released from the work, there was no feeling of release because they were carrying the misery of the work in their faces, in their hearts, in their bodies. Such misery. And this is the effect, or an effect of this economic civilization. The vital energy of human beings is squeezed out. The more there will be unrest and dissatisfaction in the people in general. So there must be revolution after revolution after revolution. Because the people aren't satisfied in this way. And they don't know where to turn their dissatisfaction, so they turn it on the government. They turn it towards crime. They become envious because they don't know what the actual goal of life is. And this is the very important mission of the Krishna Consciousness Movement. It's such a big mission. Such a big and important mission, and perhaps it is placed on fragile shoulders. But yet, Krishna has given us a great fortune to participate in this. The more there will be unrest and dissatisfaction if the people in general, although a few only, can live lavishly by exploitation. So what is it? There's some percentage, like 4% of the population uses 80% of the resources of the world. Something wild like that. The natural gifts such as grains and vegetables, fruits, rivers, the hills of jewels and minerals, and the seas full of pearls are supplied by the order of the Supreme. And as he desires, material nature produces them in abundance or restricts them at times. The natural law is that the human being may take advantage of these godly gifts by nature and satisfactorily flourish on them without being captivated by the exploitive motive of lording it over material nature. Such a powerful purport. The more we attempt to exploit material nature according to our whims of enjoyment, the more we shall become entrapped by the reactions of such exploitative attempts. If we have sufficient grains, fruits, vegetables, and herbs, then what is the necessity of running a slaughterhouse and killing poor animals? Raise your hand if you've ever been inside a slaughterhouse. Yes? No. Horrible? It was what? It was horrible. Disgusting. The screaming of the animal. How hard one's heart has to be just because you like the taste. Just like if I decided I liked the taste of Premaniti's left leg and took that as because I like it. And I took that as a justification for killing him and eating him. It sounds insane, doesn't it? Or one of Premaniti's spare ribs. And what happens if Premaniti didn't think it was spare? Who cares? because I like it. This is the insane mood that comes from putting oneself in the center instead of Krishna in the center. And it's not even needed. A man need not kill an animal if he has sufficient grains and vegetables to eat. The flow of river waters fertilizes the fields, and there is more than what we need. Minerals are produced in the hills and the jewels in the ocean. If the human civilization has sufficient grains, minerals, jewels, water, milk, etc., then why should it hanker after terrible industrial enterprises at the cost of the labor of some unfortunate men? But all these natural gifts are dependent on the laws of the Lord are dependent on the mercy of the Lord. What we need, therefore, is to be obedient to the laws of the Lord and achieve the perfection of human life by devotional service. The indications by Kunti Devi are just to the point. She desires that God's mercy be bestowed upon them so that natural prosperity be maintained by His. Kunti Devi continues, because she's concluded that after all, the only thing that is actually valuable is Krishna. This conclusion is what makes one a devotee. O Lord of the universe, soul of the universe, O personality of the form of the universe, and there he is standing or sitting on the chariot right before her, the Lord of the universe. Please, therefore, after understanding that there is nothing in this universe, nothing in existence, personally, collectively, valuable, other than Krishna, please, therefore, sever my ties of affection for my kinsmen, the Pandavas and the Vrishnis. So let me not be attached to anything other than you, anyone other than you. There are other meanings to that, and we'll read them, but we'll read the first paragraph and a half of Prabhupada's purport, which explains some of those. A pure devotee of the Lord is ashamed to ask anything in self-interest from the Lord. But the householders are sometimes obliged to ask favors from the Lord, being bound by the tie of family affection. Srimati Kunti Devi was conscious of this fact, and therefore she prayed to the Lord to cut off the affectionate tie from her own kinsmen, the Pandavas and the Vrishnis. The Pandavas are her own sons, and the Vrishnis are the members of her paternal family. Krishna was equally related to both the families. Both the families required the Lord's help because both were dependent devotees of the Lord. So the Vrishnis were in Dwarka, and the Pandavas were in Hastinapur. So whose side should she take? Should she be happy for the Vrishnis and miserable for the Pandavas? Or should she want Krishna to stay and make the Pandavas happy? But then the Vrishnis, the Yadus in Dwarka would suffer. So she was caught between these conflicting emotions. And therefore she decided it would be better to sever the ties between both of them. So Srimati Kunti Devi wished Sri Krishna to remain with her son, the Pandavas, but by his doing so, her paternal house would be bereft of the benefit, because who was Kunti Devi's brother? Vasudev. And he and the other Vrishni family members are in Dwarka. All these partialities troubled the mind of Kunti, and therefore she desired to cut off the affectionate tie. A pure devotee cuts off the limited ties of affection for his family and widens his activities of devotional service for all forgotten souls. The typical example is the band of six Goswamis who followed the path of Lord Chaitanya. All of them belonged to the most enlightened and cultured rich families of the higher castes, But for the benefit of the mass of population, they left their comfortable homes and became mendicants. So this is what it means. Because a person is valued in life by society according to his unselfishness. So someone of a sudra nature is quite selfish, and therefore he's given the lowest position in society. A Vaishya, he'll give you something, but he makes sure what? That he gets much more, at least something more than he gives, but he gives. And a Kshatriya, he gives protection, but you have to surrender to him. You have to be under his care. He will give. He is so magnanimous, a Kshatriya, is that he'll even give his life to protect you, but you have to be under his care. But a Brahmana is so liberal that he gives what he has. He keeps himself very simple, and he gives what he has and cannot take anything except if someone gives some charity for it. He cannot demand anything. He doesn't demand anything in reciprocation for what he gives. But yet, a household of Brahmana has household considerations, so he's forced, such a person is forced to have some selfishness in there, because he has to identify, this is my family, this is not my family. But a sannyasi, therefore, is considered the highest place in society and given the most respect, because their business is to simply give with no consideration. They've broken the family ties and has accepted those austerities for the purpose of identifying with everyone. So therefore, sannyasis are given the most respect. And the typical example, Prabhupada said, of the six Goswamis. And they were so much loved in Braja. The Bhakti Ratnakara describes how Sanatan Goswami would go from one village to the next in Braja, from one to the next to the next. And when he'd be entering one village, the people would hear, oh, this Bharababa is coming. And everyone would come to the edge of the village, and they would walk him, and they would offer him to the center, and they would offer him a place to sit down. And he'd say he knew them all intimately because he had been there for so many years. Oh, how is this one? How is that one? How is your family members? How is this? Oh, yes, this is okay, and this has happened. Oh, such intimate relationship with everyone. So pure. Not taking, only giving. Just giving affection, but not feeling the loss. If I have nothing, if I give what I have, and this is how it is with material things, if I give what I have, who'll take care of me? Because tama kinchana gochara, valuing nothing in the material world, valuing only spiritual gems that multiply the more that they are distributed, therefore he is fearless. So then the people of Vrindavan in one village, he would have to move on. They would, do you need anything? No, no. Please take a little buttermilk or something. Okay. Oh, I'm going. They move on. They'd walk him to the edge of their village. And then the people at the next village would say, oh, Bharababa is coming. And then they'd all come to that side. And then he'd go to the middle. And in this way, Sanatan Goswami was so loved by everyone. So wonderful. Srila Jiva Goswami gives a comment on this verse where Kunti Devi speaks. And he comments, it's from the Priti Sandarbha, and it said 115. Kunti Devi is thinking, if Lord Krishna departs from Hastinapur, that will be inauspicious for the Pandavas. And if he does not depart from Hastinapur and return to Dwarka, that will be inauspicious for the Vrishnis. Her heart thus agitated by competing affections for these two sides of her family. Queen Kunti herein prays that the affection she bears for her kinsmen be destroyed. The truth is that when she sees how the two sides of her family dearly love Lord Krishna, her own love for Lord Krishna increases. Therefore, under the pretext of saying, "Please destroy my affection for my kinsmen," Queen Kunti is really praying, "Please do not leave the association of either of the two sides of my family." And what is Kunti's actual desire? O Lord of Madhu, as the Ganges forever flows to the sea without hindrance, this is text 42, let my attraction be constantly drawn unto you without being diverted to anyone else. Kunti Devi wanted her affection to Krishna to simply increase. And this is the desire of a devotee. They have no desire in the material world. They want their affection and their service to Krishna. So again, Kunti Devi, by Krishna's mercy, by his leaving, he's allowing Kunti Devi to exhibit her heart's mood. The gem that was possibly covered deep within her heart has been brought to the surface by Krishna's leaving. And we hear and we see and we get to examine what the consciousness of a pure, exalted soul is like. And this is the essence of what it is like is that it's attached to Krishna. It's attached to Krishna, and it's wanting that attachment to increase and increase and increase, and it's not interested in increasing anything else. Nadaram najanam na sundarim kavitam va jagadish kamani mama janamani janmani shre bhavatad bhaktira. And the final verse of her prayers, which really does summarize Lord Krishna, she offers Krishna her respectful obeisances. Sri Krishna, Krishna Saka, Vrishni, Rishabhavani Drug. It's also interesting to see how one of Arjuna's names is Krishna Saka, the friend of Arjuna. So that means that one of Arjuna's names was Krishna. He was also known as Krishna, because Krishna Saka isn't Arjuna, she's speaking to Krishna, who is the friend of Arjuna. O Krishna, O friend of Arjuna, O chief amongst the descendants of Vrishni, you are the destroyer of those political parties which are disturbing elements on this earth. Your prowess never deteriorates. You are the proprietor of the transcendental abode, and you descend to relieve the distresses of the cows, the Brahmins, and the devotees. You possess all mystic powers, and you are the preceptor of the entire universe. You are the Almighty God, and I offer you my respectful obeisances. I wanted to read an example of attachment to Krishna, which is really the essence of what the Krishna consciousness movement is about. Of course, the Krishna consciousness movement, like the Bhagavatam, is written on more than one level. There are many points, as we just heard, where Prabhupada and with Prithu Maharaj and Yudhisthira Maharaj, it describes the kingdoms of great personalities, such as these great kings, and how everything flourished so well. So Prabhupada preaches on the level of organization of society around Krishna consciousness and how wonderful it would be, which also, by the way, puts great pressure on the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, on ISKCON, to be wonderful. Because if we say that if you chant Hare Krishna and people become Krishna conscious, then the result will be that society will be flourishing and everyone will be happy and honest and true and noble and non-exploitive. And if we can't demonstrate this, what happens to our preaching? So it's so important that we practice what we preach and we have a good example to show. Otherwise, our preaching becomes useless, practically speaking. But that's one level of the preaching and the purpose of Prabhupada's ISKCON. But another level is to develop attachment to Krishna. So Kunti Devi is showing what attachment to Krishna is, and that is it's so much attachment to Krishna, so much satisfaction from being with Krishna, loving Krishna, and service to Krishna, that she prefers distress while being with Krishna to being in an opulent position free from distress without Krishna. So one of the prime reasons why people come to Krishna consciousness, is to get relief from distress. But when we compare that motive with Kunti, we get a glimpse of what Krishna consciousness can really offer. Cut off all ties to kinsmen. I want my attraction to you, everything. Anukulasya sankalpa, pratikulasya vajanam. Whatever increases my attachment and love for Krishna, I want that. This is a surrendered devotee. This is a pure devotee. Whatever decreases my attachment for Krishna, I cast it away. How sincere one has to be. So Kunti Devi is exhibiting her heart in this way through her prayers and letting us know what a devotee actually desires. Let my attachment and affection to you grow like the river flows. I want it only to increase in that way. So when it increases to the highest degree, that affection and that position is demonstrated by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And it is quite extreme. I'm going to read some from Madhya Lila, chapter 2. In the beginning of Madhya Lila, Kaviraj Goswami is fearing something. He's fearing that he won't have time to describe the Antilila. Why won't he have time? Because he's elderly, he's very old, he can't sit down, every part of his body is aching, and he wants very much to share something with the devotees, and that is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's final pastimes. Because these hadn't been described by Vrindavan Das Thakur in the Chaitanya Bhagavat. He described so much, Vrindavan Das Thakur did, but he didn't describe the Antilila, the most ecstatic pastimes of Mahaprabhu, where he was exhibiting fully the mood for which he came to display, the deepest mood of Srimati Radharani's separation from Krishna. So Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami Maharaj described this Antilila in summary in the beginning of Madhya Lila out of fear of not having his life not being long enough to finish. So this is from that section. This is from the second chapter. And again, I'm reading this. Yes, not second book, but second chapter. This beginning summary that Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami writes is some of the most ecstatic writing in the entirety of the book. But again, this is to show what attachment to Krishna actually is. Kunti Devi is exhibiting it. And even by Kunti Devi's exhibition, the speaker becomes very embarrassed to have to speak about what it means to actually be a devotee. Rather, he feels he should be listening only. What to speak of hearing Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's exhibition of what it means to be a devotee and what it means to love Krishna. So I'll just read. And I'm just reading one small section. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was speaking to Swarup Damodar and Ramananda Roy. He says, "My dear friends, you are all my life and soul. Therefore, I tell you that I possess no wealth of love for Krishna. Consequently, my life is poverty-stricken." We could stop there and become very morose and lament Manushya Janama Paya Radha Krishna Bhajiya Shunya Janaya Bishakainu. Prabhupada said that was his favorite song. Poison I drink continuously, but not love for Radha and Krishna. So Mahaprabhu is saying this. My life is poverty stricken. My limbs and senses are useless. Again he addressed both Swarup Damodar and Ramananda Roy, speaking despondently. "Alas, my friends, you can now know the certainty within my heart. And after knowing my heart, you should judge whether I am correct or not. You can speak of all this properly." Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu then began to chant another verse. "Love of Godhead, devoid of cheating propensities, is not possible within this material world. If there is such a love, there cannot be separation. For if there is separation, how can one live? Pure love for Krishna, just like gold from the Jambu River, does not exist in human society. If it existed, there could not be separation." That was a Prakrita, and this is the Bengali translation of this. "There could not be separation. If separation was there, one could not live." Thus speaking, the son of Srimati Sachimata recited another wonderful verse, and Ramananda Roy and Swarup Damodar heard this verse with rapt attention. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, "I feel shameful to disclose the activities of my heart. Nonetheless, I shall be done with all formalities and speak from the heart. Please hear." Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu continued, "My dear friends, I have not the slightest tinge of love of Godhead within my heart. When you see me crying in separation, I am just falsely exhibiting a demonstration of my great fortune. Indeed, not seeing the beautiful face of Krishna playing his flute, I continued to live my life like an insect without purpose. Actually, my love for Krishna is far, far away. Whatever I do is actually false. When you see me cry, I am simply exhibiting my great fortune. Please try to understand this beyond a doubt." So what Kaviraj Goswami does, and therefore Narottama Das Thakur glorifies him, is Rasika Bhakta Maj, the greatest of all relishes of rasa. So what he does is he recites a verse, a Sanskrit verse usually, or very often from the Bhagavatam. And then what he does is explain it. He expands upon it with the words of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, giving, elaborating on the meaning and making it easier for the devotees who are hearing to relish it. So he says, "I'm just like an insect without purpose." And then he gave one verse that Mahaprabhu is saying, "Actually, my love for Krishna is far, far away. Whatever I do is actually false. When you see me cry, I'm simply exhibiting my great fortune. Please try to understand this without a doubt." Even though I do not see the moon-like face of Krishna playing on his flute, and although there is no possibility of my meeting him, still I take care of my own body. That is the way of lust. In this way, I maintain my fly-like life. Love for Krishna is very pure, just like the waters of the Ganges. That love is an ocean of nectar. That pure attachment to Krishna does not conceal any spot, which would appear just like a spot of ink on a white cloth. Unalloyed love of Krishna is like the ocean of happiness. If someone gets one drop of it, the whole world could drown in that drop. It is not befitting to express such love of Godhead, yet a madman must speak. However, even though he speaks, no one believes him. And this reminds us of the preaching of Prabhupada, how he preached, as I mentioned yesterday, as a symptom of his ecstasy, non-stop. Sometimes I think that Prabhupada was such a bad example of an old man, because like when he was 74, 76 years old, he came to India as a sannyasi, and he said, although, and he had some of the first Western disciples with him, although I am much too old to do this, I will now show you how to act as a sannyasi and preach. And then he would proceed day after day after day after day to do one program after the next, going from one person's house and preaching to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. And as we mentioned yesterday, that practically on his deathbed, he was talking about going here and there and preaching here and doing this and doing that. It was an ecstatic symptom of his great loving affection for Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and of course his Shri Master and for Sri Sri Radha and Krishna. And although most of his time, and I've been listening to so many lectures and lately in conversation, he's smashing and cutting anything that is opposed to love of Krishna. He cuts and smashes and crashes and beats on. It's very, very, very heavy. We must do this. If anyone thinks like this, if anyone doesn't surrender to Krishna, they're either they're a mudha, an aradama, mayaya, pratina jnana, or an asura. We define like that. He'll speak to anyone like that. He takes everything, when a Christian comes to, or this comes to him, or this comes, he takes everything and places it only in the perspective of love for Sri Sri Radha and Krishna. Very strongly and unshakably fixed in that position. So, unalloyed love of Krishna is like an ocean of happiness. And then I saw him in Fiji, the last time he visited there in 76. Although he was not sleeping at all, practically speaking, and he was writing and managing and doing this and this and writing letters and meeting people, he was actually completely free from anxiety, too. So he said, in the beginning, we had nothing, and there was no anxiety, and now we have so much, and there's no anxiety. It was quite staggering, because Prabhupada, although he was doing one thing after the next, he was never in the mode of passion. It was incredible. Everything was just done nicely and in such a good way and a caring way. And how he would take the hearts of those he met. Unalloyed love of Krishna, Mahaprabhu says, is like the ocean of happiness. If someone gets one drop of it, The whole world could drown in that drop. It is not befitting to express such love of Krishna, love of Godhead. Yet a madman must speak. However, even though he speaks, no one believes him. In this way, Lord Chaitanya used to revel in ecstasy day after day and exhibit these ecstasies before Swarup Damodar and Ramananda Roy. Externally, there appeared severe tribulation, as if he were suffering from poisonous effects, but internally, he was experiencing bliss. This is a characteristic of transcendental love of Krishna. If one tastes such love of Godhead, he can compare it to hot sugar cane. When one chews hot sugar cane, his mouth burns, yet he cannot give it up. Similarly, if one has but a little love of Godhead, he can perceive its powerful effects. It can only be compared to poison and nectar mixed together. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu spoke, "My dear, beautiful friend, if one develops love of Godhead, love of Krishna, the son of Nanda Maharaj, all the bitter and sweet influences of this love will manifest in one's heart. Such love of Godhead acts in two ways. The poisonous effects of love of Godhead defeat the severe and fresh poison of the serpent, yet there is simultaneously transcendental bliss, which pours down and defeats the pride of nectar and diminishes its value. In other words, love of Krishna is so powerful that it simultaneously defeats the poisonous effects of a snake as well as the happiness derived from pouring nectar on one's head. It is perceived as doubly effective, simultaneously poison and nectar." Staying near the Garuda Stamba, the Lord would look upon Lord Jagannath. What can be said about the strength of that love? On the ground beneath the column of the Garuda Stamba was a deep ditch, and that ditch was filled with the water of his tears. When coming from the Jagannath temple to return to his house, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu used to sit on the ground and mark it with his nails. At such times, he would be greatly morose and would cry, "Alas, where is Vrindavan? Where is Krishna, the son of the king of cowherd men? Where is that person who plays the flute? Where is Sri Krishna, whose form is curved in three places? Where is the sweet song of his flute? Where is the bank of the Jamuna? Where is the rasa dance? Where is that dancing, singing, and laughing? Where is my Lord, Madana Mohan, the enchanter of Cupid?" So in this way, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu exhibited and relished the most intense forms of attraction to Krishna, attachment and attraction. And one drop of that, Kaviraj Goswami said, is enough to drown the entire world. When Mahaprabhu was traveling in South India, he saw a brahmana, I can't remember exactly who it was, who invited him for lunch. And this brahmana was very attached to Lord Ramachandra. Where? In Madurai. So when Mahaprabhu came for lunch, the brahmana hadn't even started cooking. Why? He was so intensely absorbed in the mood of his service to Lord Ramachandra that he was feeling such desperation because Sita Devi had been kidnapped by Ravana. He couldn't cook. He was so absorbed in that. Not that he couldn't cook. He forgot to cook. He forgot his appointment with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He forgot everything. Like the six Goswamis who forgot to sleep, who forgot to eat because of their absorption. This is Krishna consciousness. What can we extract from the Krishna consciousness movement, from Prabhupada, this, from Kaviraj Goswami, from the disciplic succession? This is the gift. So Kunti Devi because this is the first canto, we're getting a glimpse of what attachment to Krishna is. And the glimpse, we got a hint of the power of this kind of devotional service when she talked about Yasoda Mayi. Her love for Krishna was so intense that Krishna was crying and tears coming from his eyes. So she, Kunti Devi, being in a different mood, not as in the Braja mood, was talking about the bewildering quality of Yasoda Mayi's love, meaning how awe-inspiring it was, even to her. How it had the power to evoke this type of reaction from Krishna, made the Supreme Lord, who is the omniscient Lord, as she's saying, the Lord of the whole world, who's destroying the... She has just seen Krishna destroy the political parties, both sides, destroy the burden of the world while just driving a chariot. He didn't have to do anything. He's just driving the chariot and had everyone fight each other. Job finished. But yet that same Krishna is crying when Mother Yasoda is taking a stick and threatening him, don't eat butter, don't do this again, don't steal, don't break. So we got, within this intimate glimpse, we got a still more intimate glimpse of what attachment to Krishna is and what it can do. And then, in the next chapter, not the next chapter, but the following chapter, there'll be a signboard put up. Watch this. And in the following chapter, in chapter 11, that signboard will be put up by the ladies of Hastinapur. And then in chapter 11, we'll see Krishna dealing very briefly, but wonderfully, with his queens, and understand something about what makes Krishna cry. What makes Krishna a henpecked, like a henpecked husband? And it is the attachment, the devotee's love for Krishna, causes Krishna to reciprocate with them, causes Krishna to be conquered by his devotees. But I wanted to read one other thing too. Which is in a somewhat different mood. Because by hearing about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we're looking very, very, very high, making our neck very stiff, looking so high from down at the bottom of the mountain, and looking at something so exalted. And here I am, so materialistically enwrapped, and so embarrassing, so discouraging on one hand. But here, in the instructions that Krishna gives to Uddhava, there is one song that he sings called the Song of the Avanti Brahmana. And though it's a bit long, I wanted to read it because it tells in it, it gives an example that we have more a chance of imitating, or not imitating, but acting on, to how to advance and get to the higher levels of Krishna consciousness. So this is Krishna's own words. He's going to tell a story, a pastime of something that happened in Avantipur. So he says to Uddhava, and we all possibly have had experiences like Krishna to speak of in the beginning. O disciple of Brihaspati, there is virtually no saintly man in this world capable of resettling his own mind after it has been disturbed by the insulting words of uncivilized men. Sharp arrows which pierce one's chest and reach the heart do not cause as much suffering as the arrows of harsh, insulting words that become lodged within the heart when spoken by uncivilized men. And that in and of itself is very important for us to understand how we can really hurt someone with these sharp arrows of harsh words. And Krishna himself is saying this. This should encourage us very much to gentle dealings amongst the devotees. Krishna himself is saying the arrows, the pain caused by harsh words is worse than arrows in the heart. But he continues, "My dear Uddhava, in this regard, a most pious story is told, and I shall now describe it to you. Please listen with careful attention. Once a certain sannyasi was insulted in many ways by impious men. However, with determination, he remembered that he was suffering the fruit of his own karma. I will narrate to you his story and that which he spoke. In the country of Avanti, there once lived a certain brahmana who was very rich and gifted with all opulences, and who was engaged in the occupation of commerce. But he was a miserly person, lusty, greedy, and very prone to anger. In his home, devoid of religiosity and lawful sense gratification, the family members and guests were not even properly respected, even with words. He was so miserly. He would not even allow sufficient gratification for his own body at the suitable times. He wasn't only miserly to others, he wouldn't allow himself anything. He just hoarded his money. Since he was so hard-hearted and miserly, his sons, his in-laws, his wife, daughters, and servants began to feel inimical towards him. Becoming disgusted, they would never treat him with affection. In this way, the presiding deities of the five family sacrifices became angry at the brahmana, who, being niggardly, guarded his wealth like a yaksha, who had no good destination either in this world or the next, and who was totally deprived of religiosity and sense enjoyment. O magnanimous Uddhava, by his neglect of these demigods, he depleted his stock of piety and all his wealth. The accumulation of his repeated exhaustive endeavors was totally lost. In other words, he lost everything. How? Some of the wealth of this so-called brahmana was taken away by his relatives. They found a way to steal and plunder it. My dear Uddhava, some by thieves, some by the whim of providence, some by the effect of time, some by ordinary men, and some by government authorities. Finally, when his property was completely lost, he who never engaged in religiosity or sense enjoyment became ignored by his family members. Thus, he began to feel unbearable anxiety. Having lost all his wealth, he felt great pain and lamentation. His throat choked up with tears, and he meditated for a long time on his fortune. Then a powerful feeling of renunciation came over him. The brahmana spoke as follows. Oh, what great misfortune! I have simply tormented myself uselessly, struggling so hard for money that was not even intended for religiosity or material enjoyment. Generally, the wealth of misers never allows them any happiness. In this life, it causes their self-torment, and when they die, it sends them to hell. Whatever pure fame is possessed by the famous, and whatever praiseworthy qualities are found in the virtuous, are destroyed by even a small amount of greed, just as one's attractive physical beauty is ruined by a trace of white leprosy. In the earning, attainment, increase, protection, expense, loss, and enjoyment of wealth, all men experience great labor, fear, anxiety, and delusion. Theft, violence, speaking lies, duplicity, lust, anger, perplexity, pride, quarreling, enmity, faithfulness, envy, and dangers caused by women, gambling, and intoxication are the 15 undesirable qualities that contaminate men because of greed for wealth. Although these qualities are undesirable, men falsely ascribe value to them. One desiring to achieve the real benefit of life should therefore remain aloof from undesirable material wealth. Even a man's brothers, wife, parents, and friends united with him in love will immediately break off their affectionate relationship and become enemies over a single coin. For even a small amount of money, these relatives and friends become very agitated and their anger is inflamed. Acting as rivals, they quickly give up all sentiments of goodwill and will reject one at a moment's notice, even to the point of committing murder. So he's lamenting and lamenting. Those who obtain human life, which is prayed for even by the demigods, and in that human birth become situated as first-class brahmanas, are extremely fortunate. If they disregard this important opportunity, they are certainly killing their own self-interest and thus achieve a most unfortunate end. What mortal man, having achieved this human life, which is the very gateway to both heaven and liberation, would willingly become attached to that abode of worthlessness, material property? One who fails to distribute his wealth to the proper shareholders, the demigods, sages, forefathers, and ordinary living entities, as well as his immediate relatives, in-laws, and own self, is maintaining his wealth simply like a yaksha and will fall down. Discriminating persons are able to utilize their money, youth, and strength to achieve perfection, but I have feverishly squandered these in useless endeavor for further wealth. Now that I am an old man, what can I achieve? What must an intelligent man suffer by his constant vain efforts to get wealth? Indeed, this whole world is most bewildered by someone's illusory potency. For one who is in the grips of death, what is the use of wealth, or those who offer it, sense gratification, or those who offer it, or for that matter, any type of fruit of activity which simply causes one to again take birth in the material world? The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Hari, who contains within himself all the demigods, must be satisfied with me. Indeed, he has brought me to this suffering condition and forced me to experience detachment, which is the boat to carry me over this ocean of material life. If there is any time remaining in my life, I will perform austerities and force my body to subsist on the bare necessities. Without further confusion, I shall pursue that which constitutes my entire self-interest in life, and I shall remain satisfied within the self. Thus, may the presiding demigods of these three worlds kindly show their mercy upon me. Indeed, Maharaj Katvanga was able to achieve the spiritual world in a single moment. Lord Sri Krishna continued speaking to Uddhava. His mind, the Brahmana from Avanti, thus determined that most excellent Avanti Brahmana was able to untie the knot of desire within his heart. He then assumed the role of a peaceful and silent sannyasi mendicant. He wandered about the earth, keeping his intelligence, senses, and life air under control. To beg charity, he traveled alone to various cities and villages. He did not advertise his advanced spiritual position, and thus he was not recognized by others. O kind Uddhava, seeing him as an old, dirty beggar, rowdy persons would dishonor him with many insults. Some of these persons would take away his sannyasi rod, and some the water pot that he was using as a begging bowl. Some took his deerskin seat, some his chanting beads, and some would steal his torn, ragged clothing. Displaying these things before him, they would pretend to offer them back, but would then hide them again. When he was sitting on the bank of a river about to partake of the food that he has collected by his begging, such sinful rascals would come and pass urine on it, and they would dare to spit on his head. Although he had taken a vow of silence, they would try to make him speak, and if they did not speak, they would beat him with sticks. Others would chastise him, saying, "This man is just a thief." And others would tie him up with ropes, shouting, "Tie him up, tie him up." They would criticize him and insult him, saying, "This man is just a hypocrite and a cheat. He makes a business of religion simply because he has lost all his wealth and his family threw him out." Some would ridicule him by saying, "Just see this greatly powerful stage. sage. He is as steadfast as the Himalayan mountains. By practice of silence, he strives for his goal with great determination, just like a duck. Other persons would pass foul air upon him, and sometimes others would bind this twice-born Brahmana in chains and keep him captive like a pet animal. The Brahmana understood that all his suffering from other living beings, from the higher forces of nature, and from his own body was unavoidable, being allotted to him by providence. Even while being insulted by these low-class men who were trying to effect his downfall, he remained steady in his spiritual duties. Fixing his resolution in the mode of goodness, he began to chant the following song. So this is what the song of the Avanti Brahmana. There must be a way to chant these verses very sweetly, the Sanskrit verses, but I don't know them. The Brahmin said, "These people are not the cause of my happiness and distress. Neither are the demigods, my own body, the planets, my past work or time. Rather, it is the mind only that causes happiness and distress and perpetuates the rotation of material life. The powerful mind actuates the functions of the material modes from which evolve the different kinds of material activities in the mode of goodness, ignorance, and passion. From the activities in each of these modes develop the corresponding statuses of life. Although present along with the struggling mind within the material body, the supersoul is not endeavoring because he's already endowed with transcendental enlightenment. Acting as my friend, he simply witnesses from his transcendental position. I, the infinitesimal spirit soul, on the other hand, have embraced this mind, which is the mirror reflecting the image of the material world. Thus, I have become engaged in enjoying objects of desire, and am entangled due to contact with the modes of nature. Charity, prescribed duties, observance of major and minor regulative principles, hearing from scriptures, pious work, and purifying vows all have their final aim, the subduing of the mind. Indeed, concentration of the mind on the Supreme is the highest yoga. If one's mind is perfectly fixed and pacified, then tell me, what need does one have to perform ritualistic charity and other pious rituals? And if one's mind remains uncontrolled, lost in ignorance, then of what use are these engagements for him? All the senses have been under the control of the mind since time immemorial, and the mind himself never comes under the sway of any other. He is stronger than the strongest, and his godlike power is fearsome. Therefore, anyone who can bring the mind under control becomes the master of all the senses. Failing to conquer this irrepressible enemy, the mind, whose urges are intolerable and who torments the heart, many people are completely bewildered and create useless quarrel with others. Thus, they conclude that other people are either their friends, their enemies, or parties indifferent to them. Persons who identify with this body, which is simply the product of the material mind, are blinded in their intelligence, thinking in terms of I and mine, because of their illusion of thinking this is I, but that is someone else. They wander in endless darkness. If you say that these people are the cause of my happiness and distress, then where is the place of the soul in such a conception? This happiness and distress pertain not to the soul, but to the interactions of material bodies. If someone bites his tongue with his own teeth, at whom can he become angry in his suffering? If you say that the demigods who rule the bodily senses cause suffering, still, how can such suffering apply to the spirit soul? This acting and being acted upon are merely interactions of the changeable senses and their presiding deities. When one limb of the body attacks another, with whom can the person in that body be angry? If the soul himself were the cause of happiness and distress, then we could not blame others, since happiness and distress would be simply the nature of the soul. According to this theory, nothing except the soul actually exists. These verses over here describe different philosophical perspective, different philosophies about the cause of suffering and distress. And counteracting them, he explains why they're not accurate. According to this theory, nothing except the soul actually exists. And if we were to perceive something beside the soul, that would be illusion. Therefore, since happiness and distress do not actually exist in this concept, why become angry at oneself or others? And if we examine the hypothesis that the planets are the immediate cause of suffering and happiness, then also where is the relationship with the soul who is eternal? After all, the effects of the planets applies only to things that have taken birth. Expert astrologers have moreover explained how the planets are only causing pain to each other. Therefore, since the living entity is distinct from these planets and from the material body, against whom should he vent his anger? If we assume that fruit of work is the cause of happiness and distress, we are still not dealing with the soul. The idea of material work arises when there is a spiritual actor who is conscious and a material body that undergoes the transformation of happiness and distress as a reaction to such work. Since the body has no life, it cannot be the actual recipient of happiness and distress, nor can the soul, who is ultimately completely spiritual and aloof from the material body. Since karma thus has no ultimate basis in either the body or the soul, at whom can one become angry? If we accept time as the cause of happiness and distress, that experience still cannot apply to the spirit soul, since time is a manifestation of the Lord's spiritual potency, and the living entities are also expansion of the Lord's spiritual potency manifesting through time. Certainly a fire does not burn its own flames or sparks, nor does the cold harm its own snowflakes or hail. In fact, the spiritual soul is transcendental and beyond the experience of material happiness and distress. At whom, therefore, should one become angry? The false ego gives shape to illusory material existence and thus experiences material happiness and distress. The spirit soul, however, is transcendental to material nature. He can never actually be affected by material happiness and distress in any place, under any circumstance, or by the agency of any person. A person who understands this has nothing whatsoever to fear from the material creation. And now the verse that I wanted to say. You have all been very patient. Thank you. And then the Brahmana says, Etansa astaya paratmanishtam. Adyasitam purvatamar maharshibi aham tirishyami durantaparam tamo makundandri makunangri nasevayaiva. I shall cross over the insurmountable ocean of nescience by being firmly fixed in the service of the lotus feet of Krishna. This was approved by the previous acharyas who have fixed in firm devotion to Lord Krishna, the Paramatma, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, if we can somehow remain fixed and continue in devotional service and somehow develop our attachment to Krishna so that we keep on making our attempt to serve him, by being fixed in that, somehow or another, by hook or by crook, by somehow keeping fixed in Krishna's devotional service and becoming attached to Krishna in so many forms, in the form of the Bhagavatam, in the form of the devotees, in the form of the holy names, in the form of the Dham, in the form of the deities, these very powerful forms of the internal energy in Krishna that are called Panchanga Bhakti, if we can just serve Krishna and engage in his devotional service, then we shall cross over the insurmountable ocean of nescience. And it is insurmountable, but it will shrink to the size of the water in a vatsapadam. Whoops. Please forgive me if I went on too long. It's very hard to hear for so long, and something that's essentially philosophy that needs a lot of explanation as well. But I wanted to make the point that Krishna's mercy, as it came to Kunti Devi, was always there, but it was in difficulties. But Krishna was always with her because she had fixed attachment to Krishna. And similarly, this Brahmana lost everything. He valued only this wealth, and he lost it all. And that was Krishna who came to him in that way, for the purpose of increasing his attachment to Krishna. So he was fixed. He became, by Krishna's grace, fixed in that attachment. So if we can somehow or another see everything that happens to us, see Krishna's hand in that, then jivati o mukti pade sadaya bhakti, our attachment will just hold on tighter. And we saw a wonderful example in Kunti Devi, wonderful example in the Avanti Brahmana. And look how he was treated. Who can complain after seeing what he went through? And he just remained silently fixed on Krishna. Okay, let my karma happen. Krishna's mercy. How could the tongue complain? Who will the tongue complain to when it gets bitten by the teeth? I've done this to myself. Just fixed in Krishna, paratmanishta. So that is something that we should strive for. Okay. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Kunti Devi ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Gaur Bhaktivinoda ki jai. So tomorrow we'll continue. We've finished Kunti's prayers, and tomorrow we'll continue.